and stood listening to the wind. A creaking of tin somewhere, high in the roof above him. There was yet a lingering odor of cows in the barn, and he stood there thinking about cows, and he realized they were extinct. Was that true? There could be a cow somewhere being fed and cared for. Could there? Fed what? Saved for what? Beyond the open door, the dead grass seethed dryly in the wind. He walked out and stood looking across the fields toward the pine wood where the boy lay sleeping. He walked up through the orchard, and then he stopped again. He stepped on something. He took a step back and knelt and parted the grass with his hands. It was an apple. He picked it up and held it to the light, hard and brown and shriveled. He wiped it with a cloth and bit into it, dry and almost tasteless, but an apple. He ate it entire, seeds and all. He held the stem between his thumb and forefinger and let it drop. Then he went treading softly through the grass. His feet were still wrapped in the remnants of the coat and the shreds of tarp, and he sat and untied them and put the wrappings in his pocket and went down the rows barefoot. By the time he got to the bottom of the orchard, he had 4 more apples, and he put them in his pocket and came back. He went row by row till he'd trod a puzzle in the grass. He'd more apples than he could carry. He felt out the spaces about the trunks and filled his pockets full, and he piled apples in the hood of his parka behind his head and carried apples stacked along his forearm against his chest. He dumped them in a pile at the door of the barn and sat and wrapped up his numb feet. In the mudroom off the kitchen, he'd seen an old wicker basket full of mason jars. He dragged the basket out into the floor and set the jars out of it, and then tipped over the basket and tapped out the dirt. Then he stopped. What had he seen? A drain pipe, a trellis, the dark serpentine of a dead vine, running down it like the track of some enterprise upon a graph. He stood up and walked back through the kitchen and out into the yard and stood looking at the house. The windows giving back the gray and nameless day. The drain pipe ran down the corner of the porch. He was still holding the basket, and he set it down in the grass and climbed the steps again. The pipe came down the corner post and into a concrete tank. He brushed away the trash and rotted bits of screening from the cover. He went back into the kitchen and got the broom and came out and swept the cover clean and set the broom in the corner and lifted the cover from the tank. Inside was a tray filled with a wet gray sludge from the roof mixed with a compost of dead leaves and twigs. He lifted out the tray and set it in the floor. Underneath was white gravel. He scooped away the gravel with his hand. The tank beneath was filled with charcoal, pieces burned out of whole sticks and limbs in carbon effigies of the trees themselves. He put the tray back. In the floor was a green brass ring pull. He reached and got the broom and swept away the ash. There were the saw lines in the boards. He swept the boards clean and knelt and hooked his fingers in the ring and lifted the trap door and swung it open. Down there, in the darkness, was a cistern filled with water so sweet that he could smell it. He lay in the floor on his stomach and reached down. He could just touch the water. He scooted forward and reached again and laved up a handful of it and smelled and tasted it and then drank. He lay there a long time, lifting up the water to his mouth, a palmful at a time. Nothing in his memory anywhere of anything so good. He went back to the mudroom and returned with 2 of the jars and an old blue enameled pan. He wiped out the pan and dipped it full and used it to clean the jars. Then he reached down and sank one of the jars till it was full and raised it up dripping. The water was so clear. He held it to the light, a single bit of sediment coiling in the jar on some slow hydraulic axis. He tipped the jar and drank, and he drank slowly, but still he drank nearly the whole jar. He sat there with his stomach bloated. He could have drunk more, but he didn't. He poured the remaining water into the other jar and rinsed it out, and he filled both jars, and then let down the wooden cover over the cistern and rose. And with his pockets full of apples and carrying the jars of water, he set out across the fields toward the pine wood. He was gone longer than he'd meant to be, and he hurried his steps the best he could, the water swinging and gurgling in the shrunken swag of his gut. He stopped to rest and began again. When he got to the woods, the boy didn't look as if he'd even stirred, and he knelt and set the jars carefully in the duff and picked up the pistol and put it in his belt. And then he just sat there, watching him. They spent the afternoon sitting wrapped in the blankets and eating apples, sipping the water from the jars. He took the packet of grape flavor from his pocket and opened it and poured it into the jar and stirred it and gave it to the boy.
"You did good, Papa," he said.
He slept while the boy kept watch, and in the evening they got out their shoes and put them on and went down to the farmhouse and collected the rest of the apples. They filled three jars with water and screwed on the two-piece caps from a box of them he'd found on a shelf in the mudroom. Then he packed everything into the knapsack wrapped in one of the blankets, and he tied the other blankets across the top of the knapsack and shouldered it. They stood in the door watching the light draw down over the world to the west. Then they went down the drive and set out upon the road again. The boy hung on to his coat, and he kept to the edge of the road and tried to feel out the pavement under his feet in the dark. In the distance, he could hear thunder, and after a while, there were dim shudderings of light ahead of them. He got out the plastic sheeting from the knapsack, but there was hardly enough of it left to cover them, and after a while, it began to rain. They stumbled along side by side. There was nowhere to go. They had the hoods of their coats up, but the coats were getting wet and heavy from the rain. He stopped in the road and tried to rearrange the tarp. The boy was shaking badly. "You're freezing, aren't you?"
"Yes."
"If we stop, we'll get really cold."
"I'm really cold now."
"What do you want to do?"
"Can we stop?"
"Yes." "Okay, we can stop." It was as long a night as he could remember out of a great plenty of such nights. They lay on the wet ground by the side of the road under the blankets with the rain rattling on the tarp, and he held the boy, and after a while he stopped shaking, and after a while he slept. The thunder trundled away to the north and ceased, and there was just the rain. He slept and woke, and the rain slackened, and after a while it stopped. He wondered if it was even midnight. He was coughing, and it got worse, and it woke the child. The dawn was a long time coming. He raised up from time to time to look to the east, and after a while, it was day. He wrapped their coats each in turn around the trunk of a small tree and twisted out the water. He had the boy take off his clothes, and he wrapped them in one of the blankets. And while he stood shivering, he wrung the water out of his clothes and passed them back. The ground where they'd slept was dry, and they sat there with the blankets draped over them and ate apples and drank water. Then they set out upon the road again, slumped and cowled and shivering in their rags, like mendicant friars sent forth to find their keep. By evening, at least they were dry. They studied the pieces of map, but he'd little notion of where they were. He stood at a rise in the road and tried to take his bearings in the twilight. They left the pike and took a narrow road through the country and came at last upon a bridge and a dry creek, and they crawled down the bank and huddled underneath.
"Can we have a fire?" the boy said.
"We don't have a lighter." The boy looked away. "I'm sorry, I dropped it. I didn't want to tell you."
"That's okay."
"I'll find us some flint. I've been looking. And we've still got the little bottle of gasoline."
"Okay."
"Are you very cold?"
"I'm okay."
The boy lay with his head in the man's lap. After a while he said,
"They're going to kill those people, aren't they?"
"Yes."
"Why do they have to do that?"
"I don't know."
"Are they going to eat them?"
"I don't know."
"They're going to eat them, aren't they?"
"Yes."
"And we couldn't help them because then they'd eat us too."
"Yes."
"And that's why we couldn't help them."
"Yes."
"Okay."
They passed through towns that warned people away with messages scrawled on the billboards. The billboards had been whited out with thin coats of paint in order to write on them, and through the paint could be seen a pale palimpsest of advertisements for goods which no longer existed. They sat by the side of the road and ate the last of the apples. "What is it?" the man said.
"Nothing."
"We'll find something to eat. We always do." The boy didn't answer. The man watched him. "That's not it, is it?"
"It's okay."
"Tell me." The boy looked away down the road. "I want you to tell me. It's okay." He shook his head. "Look at me," the man said. He turned and looked. He looked like he'd been crying. "Just tell me."
"We wouldn't ever eat anybody, would we?"
"No, of course not."
"Even if we were starving?"
"We're starving now."
"You said we weren't."
"I said we weren't dying. I didn't say we weren't starving."
"But we wouldn't."
"No, we wouldn't."
"No matter what?"
"No, no matter what."
"Because we're the good guys."
"Yes."
"And we're carrying the fire."
"And we're carrying the fire." "Yes."
"Okay."
He found pieces of flint or chert in a ditch, but in the end, it was easier to rake the pliers down the side of a rock at the bottom of which he'd made a pile of tinder soaked in gas. 2 more days, then 3. They were starving right enough. The country was looted, ransacked, ravaged, rifled of every crumb. The nights were blinding cold and casket black, and the long reach of the morning had a terrible silence to it, like a dawn before battle. The boy's candle-colored skin was all but translucent. With his great staring eyes, he'd the look of an alien. He was beginning to think that death was finally upon them, and that they should find some place to hide where they wouldn't be found. There were times when he sat watching the boys sleep that he'd begin to sob uncontrollably. But it wasn't about death. He wasn't sure what it was about. But he thought it was about beauty, or about goodness. Things that he'd no longer any way to think about at all. They squatted in a bleak wood and drank ditch water strained through a rag. He'd seen the boy in a dream, laid out upon a cooling board, and woke in horror. What he could bear in the waking world, he could not by night, and he sat awake for fear the dream would come again. They scrabbled through the charred ruins of houses they wouldn't have entered before, a corpse floating in the black water of a basement among the trash and rusting ductwork. He stood in a living room, partly burned and open to the sky, the water-buckled boards sloping away into the yard, soggy volumes in a bookcase. He took one down and opened it, and then put it back. everything damp, rotting. In a drawer, he found a candle, no way to light it. He put it in his pocket. He walked out in the gray light and stood, and he saw for a brief moment the absolute truth of the world. The cold, relentless circling of the intestate earth, darkness implacable, the blind dogs of the sun in their running, the crushing black vacuum of the universe. And somewhere, two hunted animals, trembling like ground foxes in their cover, borrowed time and borrowed world and borrowed eyes with which to sorrow them. At the edge of a small town, they sat in the cab of a truck to rest, staring out a glass washed clean by the recent rains, a light dusting of ash, exhausted. By the roadside stood another sign that warned of death, the letters faded with the years. He almost smiled.
"Can you read that?" he said.
"Yes."
"Don't pay any attention. There's no one here."
"Are they dead?"
"I think so."
"I wish that little boy was with us."
"Let's go," he said.
Rich dreams now that he was loath to wake from. Things no longer known in the world. The cold drove him forth to mend the fire. Memory of her crossing the lawn toward the house in the early morning in a thin rose gown that clung to her breasts. He thought each memory recalled must do some violence to its origins, as in a party game. Say the word and pass it on, so be sparing. What you alter in the remembering as yet a reality, known or not. They walked through the streets, wrapped in the filthy blankets. He held the pistol at his waist and held the boy by the hand. At the farther edge of the town, they came upon a solitary house in a field, and they crossed and entered and walked through the rooms. They came upon themselves in a mirror, and he almost raised the pistol.
"It's us, Papa," the boy whispered. "It's us."
He stood in the back door and looked out at the fields and the road beyond and the bleak country beyond the road. On the patio was a barbecue pit made from a 55-gallon drum slit endways with a torch and set in a welded iron frame. A few dead trees in the yard, a fence, a metal tool shed. He shrugged off the blanket and wrapped it around the boy's shoulder.
"I want you to wait here."
"I want to go with you."
"I'm only going over there to take a look. Just sit here. You'll be able to see me the whole time, I promise."
He crossed the yard and pushed open the door, still holding the gun. It was a sort of garden shed. Dirt floor, metal shelves with some plastic flower pots. Everything covered with ash. There were garden tools standing in the corner, a lawnmower, a wooden bench under the window, and beside it a metal cabinet. He opened the cabinet. Old catalogs, packets of seed, begonia, morning glory. He stuck them in his pocket. For what? On the top shelf were two cans of motor oil, and he put the pistol in his belt and reached and got them and set them on the bench. They were very old, made of cardboard with metal end caps. The oil had soaked through the cardboard, but still they seemed full. He stepped back and looked out the door. The boy was sitting on the back steps of the house, wrapped in the blankets, watching him. When he turned, he saw a gas can in the corner behind the door. He knew it couldn't have gas in it, yet when he tilted it with his foot and let it fall back again, there was a gentle slosh. He picked it up and carried it to the bench and tried to unscrew the cap, but he couldn't. He got the pliers out of his coat pocket and extended the jaws and tried it. It would just fit. And he twisted off the cap and laid it on the bench and sniffed the can. Rank odor. Years old. But it was gasoline, and it would burn. He screwed the cap back on and put the pliers in his pocket. He looked around for some smaller container, but there wasn't one. He shouldn't have thrown away the bottle. Check the house. Crossing the grass, he felt half faint, and he had to stop.
He wondered if it was from smelling the gasoline. The boy was watching him. How many days to death? 10? Not so many more than that. He couldn't think. Why had he stopped? He turned and looked down at the grass. He walked back, testing the ground with his feet. He stopped and turned again. Then he went back to the shed. He returned with a garden spade, and in the place where he'd stood, he chucked the blade into the ground. It sank to half its length and stopped with a hollow wood sound. He began to shovel away the dirt. Slow going. God, he was tired. He leaned on the spade. He raised his head and looked at the boy. The boy sat as before. He bent to his work again. Before long, he was resting between each shovelful. What he finally unburied was a piece of plywood covered with roofing felt. He shoveled out along the edges. It was a door, perhaps 4 feet by 6. At one end was a hasp with a padlock taped up in a plastic bag. He rested, holding the handle of the spade, his forehead in the crook of his arm. When he looked up again, the boy was standing in the yard just a few feet away from him. He was very scared.
"Don't open it, Papa," he whispered.
"It's okay.
Please, Papa, please."
"It's okay."
"No, it's not."
He had his fists clutched at his chest, and he was bobbing up and down with fear. The man dropped the shovel and put his arms around him. "Come on," he said. "Let's just go sit on the porch and rest a while."
"Then can we go?"
"Let's just sit for a while."
"Okay."
They sat wrapped in the blankets and looking out at the yard. They sat for a long time. He tried to explain to the boy that there was no one buried in the yard, but the boy just started crying. After a while, he even thought that maybe the child was right. "Let's just sit," he said. "We won't even talk."
"Okay."
They walked through the house again. He found a beer bottle and an old rag of a curtain, and he tore an edge from the cloth and stuffed it down the neck of the bottle with a coat hanger. "This is our new lamp," he said.
"How can we light it?"
"I found some gasoline in the shed. I'll show you."
"Okay."
"Come on," the man said. "Everything's okay. I promise." But when he bent to see into the boy's face under the hood of the blanket, he never much feared that something was gone that couldn't be put right again. They went out and crossed the yard to the shed. He set the bottle on the bench and he took a screwdriver and punched a hole in one of the cans of oil and then punched a smaller one to help it drain. He pulled the wick out of the bottle and poured the bottle about half full. Old straight-weight oil, thick and gelid with the cold, that was a long time pouring. He twisted the cap off the gas can, and he made a small paper spill from one of the seed packets, and poured gas into the bottle, and put his thumb over the mouth and shook it. Then he poured some out into a clay dish, and took the rag and stuffed it back into the bottle with a screwdriver. He took a piece of flint from his pocket, and got the pair of pliers, and struck the flint against the serrated jaw. He tried it a couple of times, and then he stopped and poured more gasoline into the dish. "This may flare up," he said. The boy nodded. He raked sparks into the dish, and it bloomed into flame with a low whoosh. He reached and got the bottle, and tilted it and lit the wick, and blew out the flame in the dish, and handed the smoking bottle to the boy. "Here," he said, "take it."
"What are we going to do?"
"Hold your hand in front of the flame. Don't let it go out." He rose and took the pistol from his belt. "Now this door looks like the other door," he said, "but it's not. I know you're scared. That's okay. I think there may be things in there, and we have to take a look. There's no place else to go. That is it. I want you to help me. If you don't want to hold the lamp, you'll have to take the pistol."
"I'll hold the lamp."
"Okay." This is what the good guys do. They keep trying. They don't give up.
Okay.
He led the boy out into the yard, trailing the black smoke from the lamp. He put the pistol in his belt and picked up the spade and began to chop the hasp out of the plywood. He wedged the corner of the blade up under it and pried it up, and then knelt and took hold of the lock and twisted the whole thing loose and pitched it into the grass. He pried the blade under the door and knelt and raised it up. Dirt went rattling down the boards. He looked at the boy.
"Are you all right?" he said.
The boy nodded mutely, holding the lamp in front of him. The man stood and lifted the door and let it fall over in the grass. Rough stairs, carpentered out of 2x10s, leading down into the darkness. He reached and took the lamp from the boy. He started to turn and descend the stairs, but then he turned and leaned and kissed the child on the forehead. The bunker was walled with concrete block, a poured concrete floor laid over with kitchen tile. There were a couple of iron cots with bare springs, one against either wall, the mattress pads rolled up at the foot of them in army fashion. He turned and looked at the boy crouched above him, blinking in the smoke rising from the lamp. And then he descended to the lower steps and sat and held the lamp out.
"Oh, my God," he whispered. "Oh, my God."
"What is it, Papa?"
"Come down. Oh, my God. Come down."
Crate upon crate of canned goods. Tomatoes, peaches, beans, apricots, canned hams, corned beef, hundreds of gallons of water in 10-gallon plastic jerry jugs, paper towels, toilet paper, paper plates, plastic trash bags stuffed with blankets. He held his forehead in his hand.
"Oh, my God," he said.
He looked back at the boy.
"It's all right," he said. "Come down."
"Papa,
come down. Come down and see."
He stood the lamp on the step and went up and took the boy by the hand.
"Come on," he said. "It's all right."
"What did you find?"
"I found everything. Everything. Wait till you see."
He led him down the stairs and picked up the bottle and held the flame aloft.
"Can you see?" he said. "Can you see?"
"What is all this stuff, Papa?"
"It's food. Can you read it?"
"Pears. It says pears."
"Yes. Yes, it does. Oh, yes, it does."
There was just headroom for him to stand. He ducked under a lantern with a green metal shade that hung from a hook. He held the boy by the hand, and they went along the rows of stenciled cartons. Chili, corn, stew, soup, spaghetti sauce. The richness of a vanished world.
"Why is this here?"
the boy said.
"Is it real?"
"Oh, yes. It's real."
He pulled one of the boxes down and clawed it open and held up a can of peaches.
"It's here because someone thought it might be needed."
"But they didn't get to use it."
"No, they didn't."
"They died."
"Yes."
"Is it okay for us to take it?"
"Yes, it is. They would want us to. Just like we would want them to."
"They were the good guys."
"Yes, they were."
"Like us."
"Like us, yes."
"So it's okay?"
"Yes, it's okay."
There were knives and plastic utensils and silverware and kitchen tools in a plastic box, a can opener. There were electric torches that didn't work. He found a box of batteries and dry cells and went through them, mostly corroded and leaking an acid goo, but some of them looked okay. He finally got one of the lanterns to work, and he set it on the table and blew out the smoky flame of the lamp.
He tore a flap from the open cardboard box and chased out the smoke with it, and then he climbed up and lowered the trap door and turned and looked at the boy.
"What would you like for supper?" he said.
"Pears."
"Good choice. Pears it is."
He took two paperware bowls from a stack of them wrapped in plastic and set them out on the table. He unrolled the mattress pads on the bunks for them to sit on, and he opened the carton of pears and took out a can and set it on the table and clamped the lid with the can opener and began to turn the wheel. He looked at the boy. The boy was sitting quietly on the bunk, still wrapped in the blanket, watching. The man thought he'd probably not fully committed himself to any of this. You could wake in the dark, wet woods at any time.
"These will be the best pears you ever tasted," he said. "The best. Just you wait."
They sat side by side and ate the can of pears. Then they ate a can of peaches. They licked the spoons and tipped the bowls and drank the rich, sweet syrup. They looked at each other.
"One more."
"I don't want you to get sick."
"I won't get sick."
"You haven't eaten in a long time."
"I know."
"Okay."
He put the boy to bed in the bunk and smoothed his filthy hair on the pillow and covered him with blankets. When he climbed up and lifted the door, it was almost dark out. He went to the garage and got the knapsack and came back and took a last look around and then went down the steps and pulled the door shut and jammed one of the handles of the pliers through the heavy inside hasp. The electric lantern was already beginning to dim, and he looked through the stores until he found some cases of white gas and gallon cans. He got one of the cans out and set it on the table and unscrewed the cap and punched out the metal seal with a screwdriver. Then he took down the lamp from the hook overhead and filled it. He'd already found a plastic box of butane lighters, and he lit the lamp with one of them and adjusted the flame and hung it back up. Then he just sat on the bunk. While the boy slept, he began to go methodically through the stores. Clothes, sweaters, socks. A stainless steel basin and sponges and bars of soap, toothpaste and toothbrushes. In the bottom of a big plastic jar of bolts and screws and miscellaneous hardware, he found a double handful of gold Krugerrands in a cloth sack. He dumped them out and kneaded them in his hand and looked at them, and then scooped them back into the jar along with the hardware and put the jar back on the shelf. He went through everything, shifting boxes and crates from one side of the room to the other. It was getting warm in the bunker, and he'd taken off his coat. He found a box of 45 ACP cartridges and three boxes of 30-30 rifle shells. What he didn't find was a gun. He took the battery lantern and walked over the floor, and he checked the walls for any hidden compartment. After a while, he just sat on the bunk, eating a bar of chocolate. There was no gun, and there wasn't going to be one. When he woke, the gas lamp overhead was hissing softly. The bunker walls were there in the light, and the boxes and crates. He didn't know where he was. He was lying with his coat over him. He sat up and looked at the boy, asleep on the other bunk. He'd taken off his shoes, but he didn't remember that either. And he got them from under the bunk and pulled them on and climbed the stairs and pulled the pliers from the hasp and lifted the door and peered out. Early morning. He looked at the house and he looked out toward the road and he was about to lower the hatch door again when he stopped. The vague gray light was in the west. They'd slept the night through and the day that followed. He lowered the door and secured it again and climbed back down and sat on the bunk. He looked around at the supplies. He'd been ready to die, and now he wasn't going to. And he had to think about that. Anyone could see the hatch lying in the yard, and they'd know at once what it was. He had to think about what to do. This was not hiding in the woods. This was the last thing from Matt. Finally, he rose and went to the table and hooked up the little two-burner gas stove and lit it, and got out a frying pan and a kettle, and opened the plastic box of kitchen implements. What woke the boy was him grinding coffee in a small hand grinder. He sat up and stared all around.
"Papa," he said.
"Aye. Are you hungry?"
"I have to go to the bathroom. I have to pee."
He pointed with a spatula. There was a chemical toilet in the corner behind a curtain. He didn't know how to use it, but they'd use it anyway. They weren't going to be here that long, and he wasn't going to be opening and closing the hatch any more than they had to. The boy went past, his hair matted with sweat.
"What is that?" he said.
"Coffee, ham, biscuits."
"Wow,"
the boy said. He dragged a footlocker across the floor between the bunks and covered it with a towel and set out the plates and cups and plastic utensils. He set out a bowl of biscuits covered with a hand towel and a plate of butter and a can of condensed milk, salt and pepper. He looked at the boy. The boy looked drugged. He brought out the frying pan from the stove and forked a piece of browned ham onto the boy's plate and scooped scrambled eggs from the other pan and ladled out spoonfuls of baked beans and poured coffee into their cups. The boy looked up at him.
"Go ahead," he said. "Don't let it get cold."
"What do I eat first?"
"Whatever you like."
"Is this coffee?"
"Yes, here. You put the butter on your biscuits like this."
"Okay."
"Are you all right?"
"I don't know."
"Do you feel okay?"
"Yes."
"What is it?"
"Do you think we should thank the people?"
"The people?"
"The people who gave us all this."
"Well, yes, I guess we could do that."
"Will you do it?"
"Why don't you?"
"I don't know how."
"Yes, you do. You know how to say thank you."
The boy sat staring at his plate. He seemed lost. The man was about to speak when he said,
"Dear people, thank you for all this food and stuff. We know that you saved it for yourself, and if you were here, we wouldn't eat it, no matter how hungry we were. And we're sorry that you didn't get to eat it, and we hope that you're safe in heaven with God."
He looked up.
"Is that okay?" he said.
"Yes, I think that's okay."
He wouldn't stay in the bunker by himself. He followed the man back and forth across the lawn while he carried the plastic jugs of water to the bathroom at the rear of the house. They took the little stove with them and a couple of pans, and he heated water and poured it into the tub and poured in water from the plastic jugs. It took a long time, but he wanted it to be good and warm. When the tub was almost full, the boy got undressed and stepped shivering into the water and sat, scrawny and filthy and naked, holding his shoulders. The only light was from the ring of blue teeth in the burner of the stove.
"What do you think?" the man said.
"Warm at last."
"Warm at last?"
"Yes."
"Where did you get that?"
"I don't know."
"Okay. Warm at last."
He washed his dirty matted hair and bathed him with the soap and sponges. He drained away the filthy water he sat in and laved fresh warm water over him from the pan and wrapped him shivering in a towel and wrapped him again in a blanket. He combed his hair and looked at him. Steam was coming off of him like smoke.
"Are you okay?" he said.
"My feet are cold."
"You'll have to wait for me."
"Hurry!"
He bathed and then climbed out and poured detergent into the bath water and shoved their stinking jeans down into the water with a toilet plunger.
"Are you ready?" he said.
"Yes."
He turned down the burner until it sputtered and went out, and then he turned on the flashlight and laid it in the floor. They sat on the edge of the tub and pulled their shoes on, and then he handed the boy the pan and soap, and he took the stove and a little bottle of gas and the pistol, and they went back out and across the yard to the bunker. They sat on the cot with a checkerboard between them, wearing new sweaters and socks and swaddled in the new blankets. He hooked up a small gas heater, and they drank Coca-Cola out of plastic mugs. And after a while, he went back to the house and wrung the water out of the jeans and brought them back and hung them to dry.
How long can we stay here, Papa?
Not long.
Well, how long is that?
I don't know. Maybe one more day. Two.
Because it's dangerous.
Yes.
Do you think they'll find us?
No. They won't find us.
They might find us.
No. They won't. They won't find us.
Later, when the boy was asleep, he went to the house and dragged some of the furniture out onto the lawn. Then he dragged out a mattress and laid it over the hatch, and from inside, he pulled it up over the plywood and carefully lowered the door so that the mattress covered it completely. It wasn't much of a disguise, but it was better than nothing. While the boy slept, he sat on the bunk, and by the light of the lantern, he whittled fake bullets from a tree branch with his knife, fitting them carefully into the empty bores of the cylinder, and then whittling again. He shaped the ends with a knife and sanded them smooth with salt, and he stained them with soot until they were the color of lead. When he had all five of them done, he fitted them to the bores, and snapped the cylinder shut and turned the gun and looked at it. Even this close, the gun looked as if it were loaded. And he laid it by and got up to feel the legs of the jeans steaming above the heater. He'd saved the small handful of empty cartridge casings for the pistol, but they were gone with everything else. He should have kept them in his pocket. He'd even lost the last one. He thought he might have been able to reload them out of the 45 cartridges. The primers would probably fit if he could get them out without ruining them. Shave the bullets to size with the box cutter. He got up and made a last tour of the stores. Then he turned down the lamp until the flame puttered out, and he kissed the boy and crawled into the other bunk under the clean blankets and gazed one more time at this tiny paradise trembling in the orange light from the heater. And then he fell asleep. The town had been abandoned years ago, but they walked the littered streets carefully, the boy holding onto his hand. They passed a metal trash dump where someone had once tried to burn bodies. The charred meat and bones under the damp ash might have been anonymous, save for the shapes of the skulls. No longer any smell. There was a market at the end of the street, and in one of the aisles, piled with empty boxes, there were three metal grocery carts. He looked them over and pulled one of them free and squatted and turned the wheels and then stood and pushed it up the aisle and back again.
We could take two of them,
the boy said.
No,
I could push one.
You're the scout. I need you to be our lookout.
What are we going to do with all the stuff?
We'll just have to take what we can.
Do you think somebody's coming?
Yes, sometime.
You said nobody was coming.
I didn't mean ever.
I wish we could live here.
I know.
We could be on the lookout.
We are on the lookout.
What if some good guys came?
Well, I don't think we're likely to meet any good guys on the road.
We're on the road.
I know.
If you're on the lookout all the time, does that mean that you're scared all the time?
Well, I suppose you have to be scared enough to be on the lookout in the first place, to be cautious, watchful.
But the rest of the time you're not scared?
The rest of the time?
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe you should always be on the lookout. If trouble comes when you least expect it, then maybe the thing to do is to always expect it.
Do you always expect it? Papa?
I do. But sometimes I might forget to be on the lookout.
He sat the boy on the footlocker under the gas lamp, and with a plastic comb and a pair of scissors, he set about cutting his hair. He tried to do a good job, and it took a long time. When he was done, he He took the towel from around the boy's shoulders, and he scooped the golden hair from the floor and wiped the boy's face and shoulders with a damp cloth and held a mirror for him to see.
You did a good job, Papa.
Good.
I look really skinny.
You are really skinny. He cut his own hair, but it didn't come out so good. He trimmed his beard with the scissors while a pan of water heated, and then he shaved himself with a plastic safety razor. The boy watched. When he was done, he regarded himself in the mirror. He seemed to have no chin. He turned to the boy. How do I look? The boy cocked his head.
I don't know, he said. Will you be cold?
They ate a sumptuous meal by candlelight. Ham and green beans and mashed potatoes with biscuits and gravy. He'd found 4 quarts of bonded whiskey still in the paper bags in which they'd been purchased, and he drank a little of it in a glass with water. It made him dizzy before he'd even finished it, and he drank no more. They ate peaches and cream over biscuits for dessert and drank coffee. The paper plates and plastic tableware he dumped in a trash bag. Then they played checkers, and then he put the boy to bed. In the night, he was awakened by the muted patter of rain on the mattress over the door above them. He thought it must be raining pretty hard for him to hear it. He got up with a flashlight and went up and raised the hatch and played the light across the yard. The yard was already flooded, and the rain was slashing down. He closed the hatch. Water had leaked in and dripped down the stairs, but he thought the bunker itself seemed pretty watertight. He went to see about the boy. He was damp with sweat, and the man pulled back one of the blankets and fanned his face, and then turned down the heater and went back to bed. When he woke again, he thought the rain had stopped, but that wasn't what woke him. He'd been visited in a dream by creatures of a kind he hadn't seen before. They didn't speak. He thought that they'd been crouching by the side of his cot as he slept, and then had skulked away on his awakening. He turned and looked at the boy. Maybe he understood for the first time that to the boy, he was himself an alien. A being from a planet that no longer existed, the tales of which were suspect. He couldn't construct for the child's pleasure the world he'd lost without constructing the loss as well. And he thought perhaps the child had known this better than he. He tried to remember the dream, but he couldn't. All that was left was the feeling of it. He thought perhaps they'd come to warn him. Of what? That he couldn't enkindle in the heart of the child what was ashes in his own? Even now, some part of him wished they'd never found this refuge. Some part of him always wished it to be over. He checked the valve on the tank that it was turned off and swung the little stove around on the footlocker and sat and went to work dismantling it. He unscrewed the bottom panel, and he removed the burner assembly and disconnected the 2 burners with a small crescent wrench. He tipped out the plastic jar of hardware and sorted out a bolt to thread into the fitting of the junction, and then tightened it down. He connected the hose from the tank and held the little pot metal burner up in his hand, small and lightweight. He set it on the locker and carried the sheet metal over and put it in the trash and went to the stairs to check the weather. The mattress on top of the hatch had soaked up a good deal of water, and the door was hard to lift. He stood with it resting on his shoulders and looked out at the day, a light drizzle falling. Impossible to tell what time of the day he was looking at. He looked at the house, and he looked out over the dripping countryside, and then let the door back down and descended the steps and set about making breakfast. They spent the day eating and sleeping. He planned to leave, but the rain was justification enough to stay. The grocery cart was in the shed. Not likely that anyone would travel the road today. They sorted through the stores and set out what they could take, making of it a measured cube in the corner of the shelter. The day was brief, hardly a day at all. By dark, the rain had ceased, and they opened the hatch and began to carry boxes and parcels and plastic bags across the wet yard to the shed and to pack the cart. The faintly lit hatchway lay in the dark of the yard like a grave yawning at Judgment Day in some old apocalyptic painting. When the cart was loaded with all that it could hold, he tied a plastic tarp down over it and fastened the grommets to the wire with short bungee cords, and they stood back and looked at it with a flashlight. He thought that he should have gotten a couple of extra sets of wheels from the other carts in the store, but it was too late now. He should have saved the motorcycle mirror off their old cart, too. They ate dinner and slept till morning, and then bathed again with sponges and washed their hair in basins of warm water. They ate breakfast, and by first light, they were on the road, wearing fresh masks cut from sheeting, the boy going ahead with a broom and clearing the way of sticks and branches, and the man bent over the handle of the cart, watching the road fall away before them. The cart was too heavy to push into the wet woods, and they nooned in the middle of the road and fixed hot tea and ate the last of the canned ham with crackers and with mustard and applesauce, sitting back to back and watching the road.
"Do you know where we are, Papa?" the boy said.
"Sort of."
"How sort of?"
"Well, I think we're about 200 miles from the coast as the crow flies."
"As the crow flies?"
"Yes. It means going in a straight line."
"Are we going to get there soon?"
"Not real soon. Pretty soon. We're not going as the crow flies."
"Because crows don't have to follow roads?"
"Yes."
"They can go wherever they want?"
"Yes."
"Do you think there might be crows somewhere?"
"I don't know."
"But what do you think?"
"I think it's unlikely."
"Could they fly to Mars or someplace?"
"No, they couldn't."
"Because it's too far?"
"Yes."
"Even if they wanted to?"
"Even if they wanted to."
"What if they tried, and they just got halfway or something, and then they were too tired? Would they fall back down?"
"Well, they really couldn't get halfway, because they'd be in space, and there's not any air in space, so they wouldn't be able to fly. And besides, it'd be too cold, and they'd freeze to death."
"Oh."
"Anyway, they wouldn't know where Mars was."
"Do we know where Mars is?"
"Sort of."
"If we had a spaceship, could we go there?"
"Well, if you had a really good spaceship, and you had people to help you, I suppose you could go."
"Would there be food and stuff when you got there?"
"No. There's nothing there."
"Oh."
They sat for a long time. They sat on their folded blankets and watched the road in both directions. No wind, nothing. After a while, the boy said,
"There's not any crows, are there?"
"No."
"Just in books?"
"Yes. Just in books."
"I didn't think so."
"Are you ready?"
"Yes."
They rose and put away their cups and the rest of the crackers. The man piled the blankets on top of the cart and fastened the tarp down, and then he stood looking at the boy.
"What?"
the boy said.
"I know you thought we were going to die."
"Yeah."
"But we didn't."
"No."
"Okay."
"Can I ask you something?"
"Sure."
"If you were a crow, could you fly up high enough to see the sun?"
"Yes, you could."
"I thought so. That would be really neat."
"Yes, it would." "Are you ready?"
"Yes."
He stopped.
"What happened to your flute?"
"I threw it away."
"You threw it away?"
"Yes."
"Okay."
"Okay."
In the long gray dusk, they followed a river and stopped and looked down from the concrete balustrade at the slow, dead water passing underneath. Sketched upon the pall of soot downstream, the outline of a burnt city like a black paper scrim. They saw it again just at dark, pushing the heavy cart up a long hill, and they stopped to rest and he turned the cart sideways in the road against it rolling. Their masks were already gray at the mouth and their eyes darkly cupped. They sat in the ashes by the side of the road and looked out to the east, where the shape of the city was darkening into the coming night. They saw no lights.
"Do you think there's anyone there, Papa?"
"I don't know."
"How soon can we stop?"
"We can stop now."
"On the hill?"
"We can get the cart down to those rocks and cover it with limbs."
"Is this a good place to stop?"
"Well, people don't like to stop on hills, and we don't like for people to stop."
"So it's a good place for us?"
"I think so."
"Because we're smart."
"Well, let's not get too smart."
"Okay."
"Are you ready?"
"Yes."
The boy stood up and got his broom and put it over his shoulder. He looked at his father.
"What are our long-term goals?"
he said.
"What?"
"Our long-term goals."
"Where did you hear that?"
"I don't know."
"No. Where did you?"
"You said it."
"When?"
"A long time ago."
"What was the answer?"
"I don't know."
"Well, I don't either. Come on. It's getting dark."
Late in the day, following as they rounded a bend in the road, the boy stopped and put his hand on the carriage.
"Papa,"
he whispered. The man looked up. A small figure, distant on the road, bent and shuffling. He stood leaning on the handle of the grocery cart.
"Well," he said, "who's this?"
"What should we do, Papa?"
"It could be a decoy."
"What are we going to do?"
"Let's just follow. We'll see if he turns around."
"Okay."
The traveler wasn't one for looking back. They followed him for